Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I was initially a pastor. I did that for about 10 years and thought I would be doing it for most of my life. Ended up in theological education and spent most of my life there. Actually started teaching, and then I moved to administration where you lose all sense of scholarship. So we moved from the sublime to the mundane after the first to the second presentation today. I'm looking forward to it. Hope this can be helpful to you as we talk about a few things related to shaping a theological curriculum. Perhaps a place to start is by noting that, for the most part, curricula traditionally fit older patterns that we're all accustomed to, and you know that as well as I. And until recently, they seldom addressed outcomes or the results you were looking for. You would have said you were doing that, but essentially you really didn't do it. And then primarily in response to external demands, in recent years, curricula have had some attention. In the United States, some of that demand has come from government, some of that demand has come from accrediting associations. But it brought new pressure on educational institutions to give serious attention to the kinds of results which they expected as a consequence of the academic program. Now, in some instances, there were changes that were brought about by a desire to accommodate new vocations. I can recall, for example, when almost entirely theological schools were oriented around preparing people for pastoral ministry. And so you had the Bachelor of Divinity, the Master of Divinity degrees, and you expected people who completed the program generally to become pastors or missionaries. If they were going to be involved in teaching, they went on to do THMs and so on. But in recent years, there was an awareness that if you were going to move into certain vocational callings, then the curriculum in which you were engaged at theological school probably needed to be adjusted for that specialization. And so you had degree programs that concentrated on education for Christian educators in churches and in Christian organizations. You had missions programs or majors. You had counseling programs or majors and so on. And so there was a proliferation of degree programs in regard to this realization that different vocations required different kinds of specialization and specialized training. Sometimes the effort was simply to remedy deficiencies. And I happen to have been involved in a couple of those experiences where there were external concerns that the graduates of certain institutions were deficient in several categories. And as a matter of fact, sometimes the graduates themselves expressed a concern about deficiencies. And in order to address those, the institution then would decide that some kind of curricular revision was necessary. Now, if you want to revise a curriculum or shape any curriculum in a theological school or an academic institution, it seems to me the place to begin is by acknowledging that unless you know the purpose, and unless you know the desired results of that curriculum, any effort to shape it is probably not going to produce the results you're looking for. At least it won't maximize those results. And so this is where you begin. With the purpose. and you ask yourself, what's the purpose of the curriculum of your institution? Do you really know exactly what you're trying to accomplish? Why do you have this curriculum? Why is it being implemented? And what are the desired outcomes or results that you're looking for? And are these clear, measurable, and accurate? How comprehensive are these outcomes? And have you asked yourself whether or not you may be overlooking important areas of need? You can go beyond that to ask yourself, are you sure that the curriculum you have implemented or that you want to revise is going to produce satisfactory results? Typically, we assume that's going to be the case. And we say, here are the things we're teaching. We know this is going to be what happens as a result. But it doesn't always happen. And that's why often we see deficiencies in terms of graduates or external demands for change. So you say, how do you know that you can get certain results? How will you be able to measure or demonstrate an improvement of the type you desire? And we'll get to that in just a minute, but essentially, it's unless you can find some way to examine the results of what you're doing with your academic program, you're not going to be able to do that. You'll be guessing. You may recall the phrase from Alice in Wonderland, where Alice is asking the cat as she comes to a fork in the road, she says, which fork should I take? Are you familiar with that? And the cat asks her, he says, well, where do you want to go? And she says, well, I'm not sure. He says, well, then either fork will do. It won't matter which way you go if you don't know what you're destination is. That's essentially, I think that's where we begin here today, saying, unless you really have a very specific understanding of your objectives and what you're trying to accomplish, then you may be surprised by the results. Another thing is that it seems to me admission standards probably should be included as a factor here. You say, why in the world would you do that? Because if you're looking for a certain kind of result, then the kind of student that you accept is certainly going to be a factor in that. Most institutions obviously would say we expect a statement of faith and we expect certain intellectual ability and so on. But today, with the diversity we all experience, and in many instances, the lack of adequate background in terms of the Christian faith, instruction, maturity for many students, it's a different world. And so you have to give much more careful consideration to the kind of student you're admitting. What do they know? What kind of people are there? What is the nature of their faith? What about their vocational aspiration and so on? Because if you know where they are, you're in a much better position then to take them where you want them to be. You ask yourself next, what does a student need? Here we have these students coming to us. We know this is about what they're like. Now, what are they going to have in order to function as expected in ministry? And there are several ways you can go at this, but I think one simple taxonomy has often been referred to as knowing, being, and doing. And that's simply to ask these questions. What does a student need to know upon completion of the program? We expect them to know a certain amount of information. A certain amount of content has to be mastered. And are we clear on exactly what we want that to be? Next, What does a student need to know how to do? So it's one thing to know certain content. It's another thing to develop certain skills and be able to do things well. You can know Bible information, but if you can't do exegesis, you're going to be at a loss. And we could say there are steps even beyond that in terms of the skill development. You have to move that into communicating the things that you have learned. Third would be this: what kind of person should the student be? In recent years in the United States, one of the things that has received much more attention than in prior years is what is often referred to as spiritual formation. And for years, there was very little attention was given to this matter. But the realization that students were coming from such diverse backgrounds, many without having the moral foundations that would have been expected, often experiencing difficulties that had not been true before, there's a realization that much more needed to be done in terms of the development of each student individually insofar as character, moral formation, spiritual formation. So it seems to me if you're going at this issue of the curriculum and the total student's development, you've got to consider all these factors. And a failure in any one of those may come back to create a deficiency that's going to reflect badly on the school. And you should say, finally, how should the curriculum shape the student's character or spiritual life, which is similar to the question above? Well, we've talked about the importance of purpose. We've talked about the kind of student who comes to you, what you want to accomplish with that student. But it still leaves this question. And it seems to me this is where most of us end up, and that is, why do you want to revise the curriculum at all? I mean, really, that's the basic question. What makes you want to change things? You probably could think of any number of reasons. I would say you've got to ask yourself, is it really important? What makes it so important? Why is this important to the student or to your graduate and to God's people in the church who are going to be ministered to? Can you really articulate that in a way that's satisfactory to you and to others? And then, of course, you get to this question, which is usually the driver, and that is, what about your current curriculum? How well does it function? What's the experience of your graduates? There usually is a problem somewhere, or you wouldn't be thinking of revision. Now, it's possible that there isn't a problem, that there's something else other than a deficiency. But I think that's normally the place we would start. And so we're saying, if there are things we see in our program and in our graduates that we know aren't what we would expect, then we need to address those and make some improvements. And that's what you begin to do. And that's appropriate. The underlying question with it is, are there weaknesses that are going to be very difficult for you to identify? You may see some issues in terms of graduates. You may see some issues in terms of how your school is being perceived. There could be any number of things. How do you know you can clearly identify those so that you can really rectify them? And that's often a huge problem, because you think you know what your trouble is, and then later you discover you really didn't know it at all. You can ask yourself, is it meeting the need in the Christian market, whether church or other Christian organizations? And that's a pretty simple thing to get an answer to. Are you asking reliable sources about that? Do you have some way of looking at the track record of graduates, staying in touch with them so that over a period of years, you see how well they succeed in ministry? And it seems to me every institution ought to have a way of gathering that information. Now, some of it may be anecdotal, but some of it could be very easily measurable in different ways. And you would want to find a way to do that that would benefit you. So you're asking in regard to that about your success rate, and how do you determine the success of your graduates? Do you determine it by the number who become church planters, by the growth of their congregations? Do you determine it by those who go into other different vocational callings? Are you sure how you are supposed to get a grip on that? How do you compare to similar schools in regard to the matter? Well, one of the things you could ask yourself is, what about the hidden curriculum? Every school has a curriculum, and that's a published curriculum. And the courses are clear, the faculty is listed with all the degrees and distinguished accomplishments and the like. Everything is laid out, and yet the hidden curriculum at every school is equally powerful. Not always acknowledged, but it's equally powerful. And how can you know what that hidden curriculum is? I would say one way to get a handle on this is by realizing that the hidden curriculum is a reflection of your institutional culture. And your institutional culture is essentially the embodiment of those values which characterize your institution as they come to expression in the daily function of the organization. It's possible that the hidden curriculum of your school adulates the person who has great knowledge and can dispense that. It's possible the hidden curriculum of your school is highly relational and built around an encouraging model of development. It's possible that any number of other values may come to expression in your institution and shape your students in ways you've never really thought about consciously. So all I'm saying here is there's a great deal of conversation about shaping curriculum, revising curricula, what you want to get accomplished, and very often those efforts fail because you really haven't come to grips with the hidden curriculum. And until you do that, you're not going to be as successful as you want to be. It took me a long time to realize that's the case. And I was involved in several different efforts at revising curriculum and all sort of interesting experiences. If you've been involved in an institutional experience of curriculum revision, you know what I mean by that. If you want to move forward, what you do is develop a plan to achieve the desired result or results. That's a start. Say, I know the purpose. Now I need to have a plan for what I want to accomplish. If our institution doesn't have a clear plan with specified objectives of what will be accomplished by this curriculum, we're not going to end up where we want to be. And then you look at this as an effort that will involve not only the faculty, but the board, and perhaps key leaders in your constituency. It's going to have to be a more significant effort. You want those people to understand the need for this revision and be supportive of it. Only when you have some kind of consensus of that nature are you ready to move to the next step. And that next step then would be to appoint a committee that has a responsibility for revising the curriculum. You got to give very careful attention to the composition of that committee, I can tell you. I had one friend who said he always liked to have his enemies out where he could see them. If he did that in revising a curriculum, there'd be one sure way to subvert the whole effort. You've got to have people who are going to be able to work constructively together. And they have to be committed to the objectives for that curriculum revision. They know, why do you want to revise? What do you want to accomplish? You get that set out, then you're prepared to move forward with that committee. And as you do it, you want to be sure that you have people on the committee who have the expertise to acknowledge and address the deficiencies or the expectations of this effort. You don't get the right people in your committee, it will be a terrible handicap. And what I'm really doing along with this, I think you can see, is I'm making you aware that curricular revision is a process. And if it's a process, you think about what is it that precipitates the awareness of a need to revise? How do you begin to see what needs to be revised for what results? How do you begin to get a consensus that this needs to be done and then pick the right people to get involved in doing it? So you have a whole process. And you might even, for the benefit of those who are involved, want to develop something like a flowchart that shows here's where we begin and here are the steps we move through to get where we want to be. You clarify the task, you clarify the expected outcomes or results, and you're in a position then for people to know, here's what we're trying to get accomplished, here's the way we want it to work out. Now, we can go to work. And as you do, I would say, one of the things that probably ought to be stressed more, from my own experience, I'd say that, is the interrelatedness and integrative nature of the curriculum. Typically, it becomes very atomistic. We have people teaching different courses, and we think a little about sequence and relationships, but a lot of institutions are fairly atomistic. We don't look a lot at what we're doing. We don't look over each other's shoulders, compare notes, and talk about how we can work to improve and integrate everything. I was in one situation where we worked very hard on teaching the languages, worked very hard on teaching Bible content, worked very hard on teaching exegesis. And we were doing all of that, making progress with students, and we were working on communicating skills, on preaching and teaching, and all of the elements of doing that. We had a number of experiences where students would preach, and you would have no idea they had ever studied exegesis. I mean, it was like two different worlds. And then you sit back and you wonder, what are we getting accomplished? I mean, why can't we do a better job than this? So I would say, as you wrestle with things like this that undoubtedly you're familiar with yourself, what you want to do is be sure you clarify the task all over again and the expected outcomes. And with that, get everybody to agree on certain priorities, maybe even rank order. Say, this is the most important thing we have to accomplish. And this is what it means to accomplish it. Here's how we'll know when we get there. And here are the next few things that these are very important. So if you don't have some sense of priority, the important things can get lost in the mix because eventually everybody has their own interests and priorities. So you have to prioritize the institutions. As you do that, you keep giving attention to the process and methodology, not only of the committee's work, but of the educational experience. And that's part of what I'm referring to in talking about the ability to integrate everything you're learning in biblical studies with communicating, preaching, and teaching, so that there's an appropriate kind of integration of all of this acquired knowledge and ability. How do you work that out? Sometimes we do it well within departments and not so well within the institution. Very often, even within departments, we don't work as much as we should to try to integrate all of the pieces so that it's one flow. And when it comes to methodology, again, often not enough attention is given to this. Now, I'm here giving you a session that's primarily like a teaching presentation. You and I both know that the weakest form of learning is the lecture. And yet, that's what we're most addicted to. So we should ask ourselves, what can we do to improve the learning experience? Well, we shouldn't rely totally on lectures. What other methodologies can be used that would be beneficial? And how can we begin to implement these? And very often what you have to do is spend a lot of time teaching your teachers. That is, they need professional development or training to be able to do a better job in these areas. Sometimes they don't even see how this can happen themselves. I had one experience where I had been extremely concerned about what we were failing to accomplish in terms of personal transformation and spiritual development. And we kept doing one thing and then another thing to make an improvement. Didn't get anywhere. And after a period of years, we developed a counseling program that was a clinical counseling program. And we began to see dramatic transformation of the students in that program. And so the question is, why are these students changing? And these students are not changing. What's going on? And so we began to examine that, and we made a number of discoveries that we had then to try to incorporate into other aspects of the institution's instructional approach. And I may tell you about that later, if you're curious. What about technology? We live in a world in which the growth of technology has been absolutely exponential. I just looked at something the other day. IBM had the five things that are going to change life dramatically in the next few years. We have to be aware of this and learn how to make use of it as effectively as possible. Well, the committee needs some guidelines, and I would say one of the first is, how will the outcomes be measured? Second is to realize that once you start, it's going to be political. I mean, that's why I said the committee you get is so important. And then, in spite of that, everybody has certain interests. And everybody has their own agenda. It's hard to subvert those to the interest of the group or the institution. Some people are better at that than others, and that's why you want to keep your goals, your priorities as clear as possible, and keep reminding everybody, is this going to help achieve these priority items? You want to plan how that curriculum will be presented both to the faculty and to the board once it's completed, so that you'll get the best possible reception. And then you've also got to be ready to help the faculty implement this and be highly supportive of them in implementing it. It'll mean greater change for some people than others. You notice this is, this print is a little heavier here. And this is, you know, there are a few things I'm saying that are really important. Like, you need to know why you're doing this and what you want to accomplish. You got to see the process. You got to understand it's political. And finally, maybe the most important thing I'm saying is, you can do all the curriculum revision you want to do, but it will ultimately be dependent on the faculty who teach it. And so you have to have the kind of faculty who align with what you're trying to accomplish, or it won't happen. I have learned that one the hard way, too, I can tell you. So, unless you get the alignment of faculty and curriculum, the priorities of the faculty will prevail. The curriculum will not accomplish the purpose which you have intended. It'll accomplish what that faculty wanted to accomplish, or individual faculty member. So you give careful attention to hiring and professional development of faculty for the purpose of achieving the desired institutional culture and goals. That's a big order. It does not happen quickly with a simple process. It's a long-term effort. All right. Evaluating your results. You've got to plan to do that regularly to see if you're getting the outcomes you want. Have criteria to help you do that. And then be prepared to measure everything for which you specified an outcome. Determine when and how progress is going to be measured, and be able to measure the difference from when the student enters to when they finish to 5 or 10 years after. And use the results of those outcomes to help you make additional adjustments to the curriculum, because it'll be a continuing process. And that's it. Questions?
Thank you very much. It seems to me that faculty often have very different expectations from administrators, people you come across. How can you work through those sort of expectations?
It's a good question. And the only answer I know to give is to be very careful to determine what kind of person you're considering for a hire, what their expectations and desires are. And then to try to be honest in making yours clear to them. And it's the best way to try to get a good fit. One of the things I discovered to be very helpful is to do a lot of networking to find out what people were really like. Because in a direct conversation with you, for example, I might not discover everything I need to know. You'd be more interested in pleasing me if I were the person hiring you. You might want to help us understand you a little, but you'd want to make the best possible presentation of yourself. So you network and you find out everything you can from other people. And as you do that, it helps you begin to build a profile on the person. We would look at what the person had written, what their background was, and then in bringing them to campus, we would do a lot of socializing. And we would do the typical interviewing. So you would have a person teach, they'd be interviewed by committee, interviewed by the faculty, and so on. However, we did lots of informal socializing. So we might have one person take you to lunch. We might have two or three people visit with you for coffee. We might do something else for dinner with a whole different group. And it would be one or two or three, or a husband and a wife, and all kinds of situations. And then after all of that, we would collect feedback from everyone. So then we begin to develop some kind of composite of what you were like and how good a fit you might be for our institution. And we discovered there were some people who were extremely brilliant, but they were not very good presenters. And there were others who were very smart, but they did not have the heart for ministry that we needed. And so you would discover things like this and would say, this person isn't going to fit what we're trying to accomplish. They might fit at a different kind of institution. That institution is very happy to have them research, write, come in the classroom, give a lecture, and go away. But it wouldn't fit what we're trying to accomplish. So it would seem to me that's one of the things you can do. The next thing you do is you bring a person in on a provisional basis, and you give them an opportunity to fit your system or the institution's culture and expectations. And during that initial year, you have plenty of opportunities to observe how well they're doing and how well they fit. And if it doesn't appear to be an ideal fit, you have to have appropriate ways to discuss this and do it in a supportive way to help them begin to fit what you expect. If they can't do that, eventually they'll realize in the conversations they aren't going to fit what you want, and it doesn't make them happy to try to do it, so then they're better to go to another institution. But you need to minimize those experiences. You want that to happen as seldom as possible. The more you work to build a cohesive institutional culture, the easier it will become to hire the people you really want to have. But you got to know what is it that will mark your institutional culture and the students who are shaped there.
Could you flesh out how you would measure in practice something like spiritual formation?
It's the kind of question that perplexes a lot of people. And it's the sort of thing we all need to wrestle with. I would say one of the things you can look at measuring is, what about that person's devotional life? What about the seriousness with which they approach the study of the Bible and applying it to their lives daily? What about their regularity in attending church? We all tend to look at those things in terms of spiritual development. Then we ask ourselves, what kind of person should you be as a mature Christian? How should you treat people? What does it have to do with your work ethic? What does it have to do with moral standards and various things like that? And often, it's very easy to think of spirituality only in terms of some of the formal things like devotions, going to church, and so on. Whereas you say, look, spirituality is a holistic understanding. This is the kind of person you are. And so if I'm going to be concerned about your spiritual growth, I want to see how all of this is, how is this working out in all of your different interactions with people? What about your marriage? If you have children, how is this coming to expression there? Because it's telling me what kind of healthy person you are spiritually, or the failure to become that kind of person. You can read your Bible all the time and be as mean as a snake.
So would you interview a person and score them on it?
We actually tried to do a number of things like this. And I'd be the last person to tell you I'm an expert on it. But I did discover that there are a number of analytical tools you can use to help a person understand themselves. Well, what kind of person are you? How do you tend to function normally? My wife is sitting there in the back. I ran into an analytical tool once years ago. It was called a DISC test, PerformX. But it just took about 10 minutes to do it. And then it said, here's the kind of person you tend to be. This is what you tend to operate. Well, I had her take the test. I'd already taken it. So then I had her take it. She did it. I showed her. I said, okay, here's what it is. Well, she got mad. She said, how can they do that in 10 minutes? You know. But things like this can become very helpful. And so you say, oh, I hadn't really thought of myself quite this way, but that's the way I am, and now I can see how this can be useful. Now, we often did this to help students gain a better understanding of themselves, but we also want to find ways to give them feedback in terms of strengths we saw to encourage them and areas in which they needed to make improvement. And so if you're doing this in your typical academic subjects, but you're preparing them for ministry, why should you ignore some of these more important areas that will be critical for success in ministry? So you have to find a way to try to get a handle on that. And again, the people you have helping you work on this are critical. We tried to do from the first year you entered until the last year you finished, and then do another test that was the same, and you could look at your progress and that could be discussed. And then typically we did follow-ups with alumni, and we did those in 5 and 10 year units.
Subjectivity in something called Q sorting. That's used in psychology particularly, but gives people an opportunity to rank order particular statements.
Yeah.
And it's just striking me that this might be a useful tool. There's objective assessment of that on the part of the mentor as well.
I think that would be extremely helpful. I was part of a group in the U.S. With the NAE that developed a code of ethics for pastors. And there wasn't anything of that nature that was being circulated broadly. We thought, with all the issues that seemed to surface with pastors, moral issues and personal issues and the like, maybe this would be at least some kind of helpful structure for them and even their congregations to come to grips with it. And something like that could be very useful in an educational institution. I think, for me, one of the worst things ever would be to hear that a graduate of our institution had been involved in something that was morally shameful. And I had a number of times when there was one morning, I had a call from the New York Times. One of our graduates had shot somebody at an abortion clinic. It would have been inimical to everything our institution stood for. We later learned some of the factors that were involved, but I can tell you, the last thing you ever want to have happen, either to a graduate or to your institution as a result of it, is something like that. Or you have a graduate who gets involved with someone of the other sex when he's married, and then he's out of the ministry. And you know all of these stories like this, and you say, how can we afford to ignore these things in thinking about what we're doing in educating and preparing people for ministry? We have to find some way to get a grip on it. Now, there's a lot that's subjective, but there is a lot that you can find a way to at least begin to identify and work on certain areas. Yeah, Wayne? Yeah.
So how do these churches explode with 20 and 30-year-olds with serious Bible teaching? It's a simple service, just a little bit of music and then Bible teaching.
Yeah. The answer I would give to that is that you have people with very significant gifts, leadership gifts, communicative gifts, relational skills, all of that. And with a moderate amount of biblical and theological knowledge, they can be very effective in helping lots of people. Yeah. On the other hand, you can have a person who's so highly educated, they're of no earthly good, you know? And that happens too. And part of what can occur in an educational institution is you begin to think, this is what everything is. It's all of this intellectual understanding, and now it's been dumped on me, I'm gonna go dump it on them. But life is not that way. You know, you're hitting on something extremely important. And if students come to us and they don't have some of these skills, are there things we can do to help them in terms of relational skills, communicative skills, leadership ability, and the like? I think we could learn to do better at this. That question that you've raised is one that's perplexed me through the years. So on the one hand, we realize we really need to give a good theological education, or you invite all kinds of heretical developments and the like. Good theology gives you a frame of reference. And we could see that in the first session here. That was very helpful. On the other hand, if you have good understanding, but you don't know how to work with people, then you're not going to get very far. And so we have to find a way to try to bring these things into combination. And my guess is that we're going to see more pressure on our institutions to make adjustments that will enable them to improve in areas like this. There have been things like internships and field education and things of that nature started in the 50s and have continued to develop. Most of them haven't been done very well. People have raised questions about, can we have teaching churches where you have a strong church, good staff, and you can place students in these life situations where they have to function, and they learn the skills they have to be useful. And so if we can combine what we get in the academy with what we get with hands-on personal development, whether it's coaching or whatever, maybe the combination would be a helpful kind of solution. There are all sorts of things like that people are wrestling with. That's the kind of thing that comes up when you think about curriculum revision. What do we do that will help people function better in ministry? We want the church to flourish. You know, the world has changed, and everything is so different, and we're constantly trying to make adjustments to all of that. It puts pressures on our academic institutions to do it and the like, and we will have to keep working to make that progress. I think we have to be careful we don't give a wrong mindset as part of the hidden curriculum, and that we look for ways to encourage the development of the know how to do part. Because we're very good at what you know, not what you know how to do and what kind of person you are. Those are the two weak areas where we need to give a lot more attention. And it isn't enough to say we're not doing a good job. We've got to find a way to do a better job. The other observation I'd make with this is that as we think about the fact that students who come are so different, and they're just not really that prepared, period. There's only so much you can do in a limited amount of time, and even their ability to work in a culture that's very different from what it was 40, 50 years ago, how do you work through all of these things? I mean, it's a huge challenge. And we wrestle with, well, you try to teach about culture, and you try to teach worldview. Well, you can do a little of that, and you don't get very far. So this is part of what you struggle with. And, you know, maybe what we have to look at are more things like European Leadership Forum efforts, where you have ongoing educational efforts. So one thing that typically occurs is this. Let's say you go through an educational experience, and then you're out in ministry, and you're ready to conquer the world, and then it begins to conquer you. But you don't want to quit, so what do? You look for help. And where do you look for help? Anywhere you can get it, usually. And you're happy to find sources that can be a benefit to you as you want to move forward. And that's what we have to do. And I think we have to try to find better ways to provide these resources and to make people in ministry aware of them so we can keep helping them. That'd be the short answer to it.
Mm-hmm. What are the tendencies now compared to the older days of developing a curriculum, and what should we be careful of?
Well, there's some of you in here who probably be as good or better than I at answering that, but some of the changes have been very obvious. One is the proliferation of degree programs to reflect vocational interests. The other has been the development within certain disciplines has led to all kinds of changes. Say biblical theology got a whole lot more interest in the last 40, 50 years. There have been any number of things of that nature. I can remember when counseling was anathema to most evangelicals, and then it became acceptable, and then you started to find ways to help people get the right kind of instruction. So we've worked through any number of things like that. It seems to me that one of the things that is a very dramatic change right at the moment is online education. I mean, I mentioned technology, but I didn't really talk about online education. However, that is something that is going to dramatically affect education. It's very easy to deliver content online. But what you do in terms of the other things, it's much more difficult to accomplish. So I think we're going to see more things like this. It seems to me that one of the possibilities is we can learn to capture some of these new resources. For example, we could use technology to get, for a given course, you could have two or three of the very best professors doing presentations instead of only one, two or three. You could have some discussions and dialogue. You could do any number of things we don't ordinarily do right now. And you say, why don't we do more of this? It's so beneficial to have questions and talk and interact. Why can't we find ways to make some of this available or get this sort of group interaction going? So I'm not sure of how it'll work out, but I think we're going to see more of that. I also think that because of financial pressures on educational institutions, that will force certain changes. And the other thing that's going to do it is in the U.S., the biggest growth has been independent ministries. And in independent ministries, you don't have to have a seminary degree. You don't have to go through that academic program. All you have to do is go out and be successful in ministry. You don't think that'll put some pressure on things? It will. So maybe one of the things we'll see is, who knows, maybe we'll see more of a clustering of research and writing and making that available, as you would have with all the books that are here and everything, and then more of an effort in the true development of people, the skill development and all that they need. So you find a way to be sure you do good work in both areas. And it's the spiritual formation and the skill formation that's going to have a lot more attention. Because for most people, you have to get it either before or after your academic program. And that won't be satisfactory for the long term. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.